I would say another episode of We the People Radio, but we haven't been here in a few weeks because we got tied up. So we're sorry we had you listening to archives, although they were really good archives. But today is the 23rd of October, 2022, and we got two guests for you today, people that you've never heard from. So we thought we'd come back with a bang. How's that? So Bill might have some sponsor information.
Oh, I was waiting for you to identify yourself, but
I'm not gonna.
You're not gonna?
No.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, I'm here.
Well, I'm not gonna either. Our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape will get you pretty much anything you need in the way of tractors, implements, parts, service. They do it all up there. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake. Or give them a call at 226-9226, and they can pretty much take care of any of your ag or turf questions. Or you can catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. There you go.
And the I have multiple free advertisements to do, but I'm going to do them one at a time.
Oh, well, that would be great, because if you do them all at the same time, you get kind of confusing. That's a good pick.
No, but I'm going to do one this week, one next week, because we have come across some really amazing professionals. So if you're thinking about financing something like a house and you actually want to get it done in record time, you should call Valerie Volbrecht over at Summit Funding. And her email is teamvalerie@summitfunding.net, and you can find her at 530-410-6478.
Does a great job.
Does an amazing job.
Yep.
Actually, it was an amazing job. It's pretty difficult to buy a house and move into it in under 30 days, but Valerie and her team of professionals, the greatest part about that was she steered me to some terrific people. And they made all the difference for us. So, Valerie Volbrecht at Summit Funding. I'll give you the number again. It's 530-410-6478. Or you can contact us and we'll reiterate that for you. Our phone numbers and email addresses are on the web at wethepeopleradio.us.
There you go.
There. How's that?
So who do we have today?
Yes. Well, we have two terrific people that we have never spoken with before, so brand new information for us. Scott Cleland is up first. He's the executive director of the Restore Us Institute. I'm having trouble seeing this here. My glasses have gone all crazy. A nonpartisan nonprofit that educates the public about internet accountability problems and solutions. None of us have ever had that before.
No.
Cleveland was Deputy U.S. Coordinator for International Communication and Information Policy in the H.W. Bush administration. And you can find him at restoreusinstitute.org. And I posted the article that he wrote, which is how we found him, through his terrific publicist, Stephen Manfredi, who sends us just the most interesting people ever. So he had an article in Town Hall, and we'll let him tell us about it. Scott, sounds like you might be in there.
Yes, I am, Aaron. And Bill, thank you for having me. Long format's very helpful on this.
Yeah, you know, but there are too many things that can't be done in a minute and a half, and so we try to be the venue for that.
Exactly. And if I can just give a little bit more context on Restore Us Institute, is we're the only entity right now that is trying to help all of the individual internet problem groups. And we know there are dozens of things wrong with the internet. And there are great people working to solve one with one piece of legislation. The problem is they all are not able to create critical mass. And what we do is we have now the research to basically back up that there is one root cause for almost all of the internet unaccountability problems. And once you know the cause, you know the cure. And so there is a, what we're all about is trying to do that holistic fix on solving the problems. So what is the universal problem? And that is in 1996 and 1997, we had basically new internet policy that was set. And what it did was set an absence of government, whether it was national, whether it was legislative, whether it was judicial, or executive branch. The common theme was no government. And that made sense for the first, you know, 5 to 10 years in getting adoption of the Internet and getting it built out. But as an operating idea for everything, everyone using everything everywhere for life, work, and play, it is, you know, approved anarchy on online on autopilot, and it's been a disaster. And so we have a simple solution to that, and that is to restore constitutional accountability over the U.S. Internet in U.S. policy. And what does that mean? That means same rules and rights offline and online, equal protection under the law. And if it's illegal offline, it's illegal online. So hopefully that's not more than you needed, but it's an important context about what we're all about.
Kind of give people some examples. Like what? Like I don't want to say in rank order, but yeah, maybe in rank order. Like what do you think
the problem?
Yeah.
Oh well, it's don't look at this as you know the which ones are the top ones, but you know there are so many. Most Americans themselves or have loved ones that have been victims of cybercrime, mm-hmm. cyberbullying or harassment, or other cyber harms. What are some of those? Elder fraud is a huge one, but the fraud category, you know, there are literally, you know, 5, 10, 15, depending on how you want to slice it, of really serious fraud problems. Obviously, crypto has been a huge problem on fraud. But then you have all sorts of types of abuse of people, from predation of children, sex trafficking of minors, you know, sextortion. I mean, there's just all sorts of things that can be done badly to people. And then, you know, there's clearly, you know, many kinds of cybercrime. And, you have things like you probably have seen, you know, flash mob and robs. That's an Internet problem. Mm. You have cyber espionage, where the Chinese literally can do whatever they want to us and steal our greatest secret. And Russia and Putin do the same thing with ransomware and with cybercrime. They're the ones pulling the puppet strings behind that, letting it happen and not letting it happen. That's just, you know, identity theft. Oh, one I can't believe I didn't mention up front. If you want to say how this is killing people, 100,000 Americans died last year from fentanyl poisoning. How is that Internet related? Well, 97% of all online pharmacies are illegal. Almost all the 35,000 are overseas.
Wow.
And so how people get, you know, it's like, did they get it on Instagram? Yes. They get on Facebook? Do they get it from the loyal, local drug dealer? Yes. Where do they get it? Well, it's just flooding in from the Chinese, generally going through Mexico. But how people get it and find it and then die is because they think they're getting safe medicine. And there's a great organization, safemedicines.org, that works on this. But like this, that problem, there are problems like this all around. Enough is Enough, another good organization that's trying to do, you know, keep children safe from sex harms and all that. But you know, the overall problem is caused by U.S. policy allowing it, tolerating it, and ultimately promoting it. And they've been doing it. Let me put this in perspective. 5 administrations, 13 Congresses, and 17 Supreme Court justices have neglected to protect the American people and minors from online crimes and harms for 25 years. Excuse me for hearing my indignation, but this is just, I call it mindless madness. We had to come up with a new word to describe this because it's so far beyond the pale, you know, that the government hasn't done what its purpose is. I mean, we the people, aren't we the people that are the, you know, consent of the governed, and aren't they the one, aren't the people the most important that are supposed to have the most power in America? Haven't been that way since Internet policy. So hopefully that's a good background to start from.
So the things you're describing are illegal. They're illegal online and offline. But what you're saying is we don't enforce it like we do offline. I mean, if you were trafficking children, you're going to get arrested and thrown in jail. If you traffic children online, it's much harder to catch these people, or are you saying they just don't go after them?
Bill, you're looking at this almost on base, but let me tell you what makes this so crazy, and then you'll understand better when I'm saying what you say. Is it are these things illegal online? When you look at what they've done, is they have basically taken away sovereignty. So that's all the international stuff. We gave up, the normal kind of sovereign control over our borders. So we have an open digital border, free flow of information. Well, information can take any, data, any form. Mm-hmm. And so it can be coming in as a cyber attack. It can be coming in as a fentanyl drug deal or whatever. And it isn't illegal. Some things, like some sex trafficking now is. But that's the only law that's passed in the last 25 years. It's called FOSTA and SESTA. But what's different with this is when the federal government said we have no government online, they said we want them to be unfederal by federal or state regulation. So what they did was set a policy that they didn't want any government on the Internet or any control. So that means no constitution, no rule of law, no rights. And when they did that, they basically said, we're now going to create jurisdiction. They don't use that word. I'm just using that to help people understand it. Where they basically said online, if that was considered a jurisdiction, they want that to be government-free. They also were saying, which is a Tenth Amendment problem, is they preempted state rights and the local rights that went away, along with it, and the people. As you all know, people and then local and state, it goes up that way. But over time, in different ways, the policy, whether it was in Congress, executive branch, administrative agencies, or through the court system, they had different things that made it so that everybody was shut out. Like, for example, if you brought on a victim of fentanyl where they lost a child or something, or other things where they were defrauded, like I know of one person who lost $150,000 through an online scam. So they went to the police. Well, of course, you get stolen, $150,000. Well, and they, most of the time, they have to say, it's not our jurisdiction. We want to do it, but we can't do it. We've been basically, and they say, in your instance, you need to go to the FBI. Well, if you call the FBI and say you've been financially defrauded, this applies to elder fraud and others, they'll say, how much did you lose? And if you lost less than $1 million, they don't have the time or staff for you.
Yeah. Wow.
Not.
Yes, and I've heard that more than once.
If you're defrauded, only the people that get defrauded a lot get justice. So there is no justice online. It just doesn't exist. And why other people, why you haven't had, 50 people come on as experts and talk about this. I've been doing internet policy for 30 years since the beginning, before it was there. And I've been an analyst and been known as, somebody who knew what was happening before it happened. And I've been working on this, depending on how we slice it, 3 or 4 years ago, I realized as a researcher and a thought leader in this space, no one had ever pulled together all of the negative dynamics and crime waves and things on the Internet. And, of course, we have heard everything positive. I mean, big tech and everybody, they can't sing the praises enough. And, look, I think there were tremendous good things that came out of it. But they have buried and hidden and not talked about it. So, literally, the last 3 years it's taken me, but I had to develop a new research discipline. Not the first time. I did change research a while back for investors. But here, think about if you were trying to understand the economy and there was only micro-internetics, basically for businesses and whatever, and there wasn't something for overall that pulled it together. Well, that's the problem on the internet, is no one had done what I call macro internetics. And so it's nuts, the fact that people haven't figured out and talked about it. It's not that people don't know the problem.
Right.
They're looking at them individually, piecemeal. They're taking a straw and looking at it, or they're taking a microscope and looking at one thing. The thing about the internet is it's all unitary. It is all, you know, it's a holistic system. It all behaves the same way on its holistic principles and holistic technology. And so, and the policies are holistic. So it's really not that complicated if you look at it whole. That's what our innovation is. That's where we can be very helpful. And people should be encouraged that the mindless madness out there can be fixed. But
yeah,
the people have to come together and expect it.
Well, and without, I have an example. When we come back, I have one. We did a show quite a while back on suicide predators that utilize the internet.
Yep.
And at that time, we didn't even know there was such a thing. So that was really alarming. But then as we looked into the policy of how you fix it, you get into the whole censorship thing. So then who's deciding what's okay? Maybe when we come back, you can, or at some point, we'll walk through that part. All right.
Please.
Our guest this morning is Scott Cleland. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
So back in like 2013, maybe 2014, we had a dad came on the radio, live local here. His daughter had gone to the University of Florida, and they noticed kind of a change, and they kind of chalked it up to, well, you know, she's a freshman in college, and she's far away from home and all that. Well, bottom line, she had become very depressed, and they didn't know that. And she had gotten online and joined some chat group that's like a suicide chat group. I guess they have a chat group for everything. And there were people, I'm sure there are many more now, but back at that time, who were trolling the internet in those kinds of chat rooms looking for people. And they would say, oh, I'm depressed too. They basically became their suicide pal. And in a lot of cases, like the dad had done a whole lot of research on this. And so not only did they walk his daughter through how to buy, what's the chemical? Cyanide. She bought cyanide and taught her, and the information was all online on her computer. How to use it, what to do. And okay, I'm going to do it too. All right, let's do it now. 10987654. Like, and then that person disappears and the daughter's dead. And he was thinking, there has to be a law against this. This is crazy. Like, how could people do that? He was in a different state, and that was what tied their hands. They did figure out who the guy was, though. Has that changed, or is that still an open problem?
It's still an open problem.
Wow.
Like, on elder fraud, at least the Justice Department really is prioritizing and working on it. But every way that you can defraud and more, the bad guys have figured it out online.
I mean, sure.
Especially with teenagers and, you know, getting them to, as you were talking about, self-harm or suicide and, but, you know, how kids get groomed by predators. But I mean, there are a whole bunch of other ones, like revenge porn, it's called, sextortion,
oh, right.
which is, you know, people having pictures of you and then they extort you over the phone or whatever. So the fraud aspect, that's another thing where all of this fraud is enabled, promoted, and tolerated in U.S. policy. And, you know, so it happens with impunity. And so this is, it gets marginally better in certain times when Washington says, oh boy, this is serious, we better pay a little attention to it. And they pay attention to it and they get some good press and whatever, and generally they don't stick to it. Elder fraud may be one exception, but and, you know, child predation, that's an area where recently it's gotten much better. But it took 20-odd years.
What's the holdup? If you were gonna switch teams and you were gonna lobby against what you're advocating, what's the pushback?
The pushback is, oh my goodness, somebody might regulate the internet.
Right.
And we can't regulate the internet because, you know, the internet will die and we won't have the internet. So they'll give you an argument that says, and that's what big tech will do, is they'll say, you know, that the policy, if it is changed, and if somebody looks at the policy wrong, and I'm being a little bit facetious here, but, you know, it won't work, and it'll cause all of these problems. And they've been making that argument for 25 years. Anytime anybody wants any accountability for them, they are the most entitled, pampered group of people you will ever find on the planet. And if anybody wants to, you know, keep them from getting their $1 trillion cap or allows them to do whatever, they will say, you know, that's, you know, with disruptive innovation, we have to be able to do that. Of course we need to do it. And innovation is only good. There's all sorts of terrible innovation. They've made it out that innovation is only good. Criminals and predators are the most innovative, and they have always been the leading edge of innovation in a new market.
Yeah,
and that's why
true.
Crypto is so corrupt. So but that's what they'll say. They'll say this is just going to be big government and it's going to be big regulation. And what's ridiculous here is this is not, what we're basically saying is the laws that apply offline that people are being protected by should protect them online.
Sure.
I mean, it's just common sense because think about it. The internet now, and it hasn't been until the last 5 to 10 years, it is totally integrated so that everyone does everything everywhere on life, work, and play. And you either do it in person while you're talking, or you might pick up your phone and then you're doing it online, or you might get on your laptop or some other device, but or your Ring outside your door. All of this stuff is connected to it. But it's basically you and it's basically another person, and they're not different. It's just they're doing it over a different dimension. But everybody bleeds, bruises, and dies the same way. Everybody defrauds and abuses and attacks the same way. And so the fact that we have created this alternative artificial universe, which is now going to be called the metaverse, where there's no accountability, no rule of law, no rights, no recourse, no access to justice. You're on your own. Wild West.
Yeah.
Might is right, and spite is right.
Well, there are things popping up, too, and I have not had a chance to research them. And actually, I'll email you once I find it. So I know it's in my notebook at home. Had a lady, lives in a rural county here, and she was got up in the morning, got some kind of an email that said, you know, they're trying to hack your bank account. Your bank account is being hacked. This is Microsoft. And then her phone rings, and this is so-and-so from Microsoft. And, you know, they're trying to siphon money out of your bank account. Didn't ask her for any personal information or anything, but did know about this supposed hack. Well, before she could do anything about it, her phone started ringing with a number out of New York. And she said, hold on, I have another call. And the person on the line said, oh, if it's from New York, it's the hackers. That's where they live. And so she didn't take the call. And she was really skeptical of these people, so she didn't give them any good information or anything. But before she could really make a whole lot of decisions, probably 5 minutes went by, and there's a knock on her door. It was the local police department.
And the policeman said, "Are you on the phone?" And she said, "Yes." He said, "Leave your phone inside and come outside." So she leaves her phone on the counter and goes outside. And he said, "You're on the phone with people that are trying to hack your bank account. We've been contacted by this group who actually is out of England using a New York number who monitors the internet for cybercrime. And apparently, because she wouldn't take the call, contacted her local police department and, like, stopped the whole thing." But I mean, I've never even heard of that before.
Yeah, that's pretty complicated ruse.
Have you ever even heard of that before? I mean, this just happened like a month ago.
It is. They are so sophisticated and so clever. I mean, I have, sometimes I shake my head because when I see them or they come at me in whatever firm they are, I'll go, wow. I just, the thing is you just have to, when you have any doubt or you have any thing you don't understand, it's fraud. You have to have that mentality.
Well, it turned out the people from England who called the police were not trying to defraud her. They were trying to warn her. She was on the phone with the people. But how would they know who she was on the phone with, and how would they know that the fraud people were contacting her? I guess.
And the thing is the fraudsters are so sophisticated. They come with information because they bought it on the dark web.
Sure.
And so they know a lot about you, and they'll make you comfortable, and they'll say, "Well, I know this, this, and this." And then they also know where you bank, and so they've been doing this for so long, they also know the bank and what it has, and they'll throw out a few pieces of information there that sounds like they're legit. And so it is really, really hard as a, even professionals, are scammed. I mean, that's how they broke into, how the Chinese, through phishing, literally broke into every Alphabet Soup government agency, all the military and the enforcement agencies, all of the cabinets, and all the Fortune 500. I mean, the FBI director basically, said it's the biggest wealth transfer in world history, that they stole about $500 billion worth of trade secrets, and that was probably 6, 7, 8 years ago.
Wow.
So it's only gotten worse. I mean, the cybercrime industry is a multi-trillion-dollar problem.
And is a lot of the cybercrime, is it a lot of that is state sponsored,
state enabled, or especially like with Russia, it's they are allowed and have connections. And then if Russia ever gets squeezed too much, they might, tell somebody to back off. But it's just like, North Korea has a bunch of bad guys, China has a bunch of bad guys, and Iran do. And they, and the crazy thing, the mindless madness here is we have a policy that literally aids and abets our most dangerous adversaries. Because we, basically, it's an asymmetric warfare, asymmetric risk. And we basically let all the stuff flow in, and then we try and deal with it once it's done. So it's kind of like saying we have a policy of, we don't protect our animals until, the barn door's been opened and they're all outside and we have to chase them down. That's essentially where the government is. It's not that they're not protecting you. They wait until it's happened. Mm. Like the ransomware thing that happened with energy on the East Coast that, messed with for a good, 10 days. But, that was Russia, and it was, very debilitating. And the scary thing is with that policy, if all those four countries got together and decided to, basically do all the things they do all at once, it would be total chaos. And we have very good cyber stuff, but that's warfare. And what I'm saying is in the Homeland Security or the public safety or law enforcement, is if that information's coming in and it's doing mayhem and it's harming people, that is basically being tolerated and promoted and allowed by U.S. policy, and it has been. That's why all these problems are so out of control and not getting fixed. Mm. And it's we only get involved with the military once it gets escalated to, you know, but by that time, all these people have been hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
You were going to say something about censorship. I should get back to that.
Yeah.
It's very important.
Because that's got to be the biggest, I mean, the guy with the daughter who was murdered by the predator because he was out of state and because he was online and he never physically contacted her and all of those things, then it didn't really qualify at that time anyway as murder because she didn't have to do it. He wasn't standing there. And he never had any real contact with her. But there was this giant long con and mind game that, I mean, I would argue did make him responsible. But the big pushback was, well, you can't monitor everything everybody says online and then, you know, who decides if that's a risk or not.
And now this gets us into censorship because
yeah.
The thing that most media, most people... Here we hear about literally each side on the right and left scratching each other's eyes out online. You know, the political, they fight over the exact same thing. And on the right, they look at that thing and they say this moderation, content moderation, is censorship. And that's the way they call it. And then the left looks at it and says they think that's misinformation or disinformation. And big tech knows that. They know that if they can keep free speech and say free speech is what should drive the internet completely, like free speech absolutism, and that as long as they have both political parties clawing each other's eyes out on that and literally spending most of their time raising money so that they can claw the other side's eyes out more, and that's the game. I mean, they are so focused on that battle, they've totally lost sight that there's an American people out there to protect. And so why would I say this? Because you hear about censorship and big tech, and if you look at the parties, they'll talk about how, you know, they are, you know, a big problem on this, depending on which side you're on. And the thing is free speech, generally it is a celebrity or an influencer or a politician who is making the complaint about, either censorship or disinformation. Let's put this in perspective. The way I like to describe it is the things that are like that, where you're really fighting over, you know, a specific case, that's like 5% of the internet problems. When you look at this holistically, you know, something that would elevate to that, like a free speech thing. I mean, think offline. I mean, is more than 5% of crime offline related to free speech? Of course not. It's probably way less than 1%.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, and what I'm trying to tell you is, and they spend 95% of their time on that 5%, basically raising money, doesn't matter which side you're on, looking at things, and they'll literally flood you with robotext, robocalls, with emails of, you know, fund this because we need to do it in order to win. And they've totally forgotten the American people, the 95% of crimes which we've discussed that are being ignored and promoted and actually encouraged by both sides because of their neglect. It is a dereliction of duty by the whole government over a long period of time. And the problem is early on, you're not going to believe this. I mean, this, when I found this, it took my indignance, you know, to the stratosphere. But let me explain that.
Scott, hold that thought. We'll come back and be indignant.
Okay.
Yes, I don't want to cut you off in the middle because, you know, a good rant's hard to find these days. Okay, not really, but.
I'll do it quickly. The free speech, the Supreme Court, basically, their only decision was Reno versus ACLU in 1997. That was the case.
Uh-huh.
And they overturned it 9-0 because on technical matters, it was an abridgment of adults' access to porn because it was too sweeping. Well, that was called the Communications Decency Act. but it had a very righteous and good criminal provision in it that was also overturned by the Supreme Court, because when they, you know, there were 8 parts of it that were bad, and they said, oh, precedent says it's easier just to knock them off. Well, do you know what one of those things was? And I figured this out only because of my research, and when I read it, I went through the roof. Because there was a law that was the law of the land from 96 to 97, which called Section 508, and it said that, you know, for it is a 10-year prison fine, and, you know, and it also had her sentence, and then fines for coercing or enticing a minor or children for sex and sex trafficking. Now, everybody that is sentient or has a conscience knows that pimping children for sex coercively is a crime, mm-hmm. a heinous crime,
yeah.
one of the worst crimes you can have. Well, the Supreme Court, not looking at what else was in the, because I think if they really thought it, they just applied the precedent and didn't look. And so, once again, bipartisan, it was a big mistake in my eyes. But what did they teach the judiciary for the next 25 years? And everybody that did the research and looked at it says, wow, you know what? If the Supreme Court says it's protected constitutional free speech to pimp children or coerce them, then that's how we now get decisions that says, you know, terrorist funding for Hamas is free speech.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, I always wondered how, they squared that, because that seemed like a pretty loose interpretation. How about that? Let's come back and talk about this a lot more. We'll be back with our guest, Scott Cleland. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
.us.
All the gold in California is in a bank in the middle of Beverly Hills in somebody else's name. So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter.
Hated to interrupt you in the midst of the legal beagling, but go back to that, Scott, and kind of expand on that a little bit on how we got here with the Supreme Court, because I don't think most of us followed that at all.
No, and that they wouldn't. That is something I learned, but it essentially the Supreme Court in this area. The other thing they did is they assumed. Because, you know, when you make a decision back in 1996, it was 1996 kind of fact. The Internet then was used by one senator. So that was Leahy. A few percentage of Americans were early adopters. And in 1996 to 1997, Americans used the Internet an average of 30 minutes. A month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
A month. So people were using it a minute because it was so slow. Now, they basically, that was their decision then, you know, that they and porn was the innovators, and that was actually already quite developed at that time. But none of the, you know, we never thought about social media or any of that other stuff back then, or a smartphone. And so they made a free speech absolutist view, because the other thing that's crazy about this is that there's only one internet law. It was that sex trafficking. It took 20 years to fix that, and that was done a few years ago. But defamation was the only law that got into the 1996 Telecom Act. So basically, big tech said, this is such a great thing for us, is we're going to basically say there's only one problem on the internet, and that's defamation. So that's why everybody spends all their time on free speech and everything on censorship, because there's only one law. And back then, they only thought, oh, this could be just a publisher or a speaker. The problem is the Internet is an all-purpose technology that can be, that was used for e-commerce. So anything, and we know you can't lie and cheat and steal in business and not have it be legal online, but they basically made it legal online. And so that's why we have, you know, have so much fraud. So it just was a case where the Supreme Court didn't get back to it. They did get back to it on property, and they shut down Napster and they shut down Grokster, you know, radio and video. But they, other than that, they've had kind of this absolutist, and they need to wake up. I think they will kind of look at it in the next year or two, or next year. They've got cases. But, of course, that's both parties wanting them to say, choose one party over the other. Is it instant censorship or is it misinformation? And it's both.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is the Supreme Court's got to focus on this, and they've got to realize that, you know, like they've done offline, they have created things that are unprotected speech. You know, you, and we know what they are. You can't incite a mob. You can't have fighting words. You can't, you know, joke about being a terrorist and, you know, trying to get on a plane. That's illegal. It should be illegal because it can create chaos. But there are other, you know, you can't lie. You can't perjure yourself in contracts or in court, and there's defamation, there's slander. So there are things that are, you know, you don't have free speech absolute off here. And the thing is the Supreme Court's got to wake up and realize that online, because they've let this run on autopilot for 25 years, there are many more things that are crimes that are done through the spoken word or through speech, because that's what the law and what the precedent and what the technology allows, fosters, and multiplies. So they're just so far behind, and they've got to basically, you know, there's no right and wrong. There's no justice online. There's no access to justice. And the reason why there's no access to justice is because big tech many years ago figured out that they could get summary judgments. Anytime you sue, they would get a summary judgment, and before a complainant could even get a deposition, they would be thrown out of court. And so that's been the reality, no access to justice for the last 25 years. Big tech, you know, I mean, I maybe this is a little bit of hyperbole, but the amount of money they spent on legal fees over the last 25 years is in the billions. Of just legal fees.
Wow.
In order to basically keep the status quo. And, you know, small countries could run on that. You know, how it's happened.
One of the things that it's kind of bouncing around in my head is if law enforcement was to go after all these crimes that are happening on the Internet, do we have the manpower to really?
Yeah, I was just going to say, look, what's the enforcement mechanism that you envision for this? If they did write a really good law and these things now were not legal, who would be or what would be the
branch or
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to enforce?
Yeah, who does this? Space Force.
Well, and that, the thing is we have a systemic, you know, disequilibrium. So the system is completely discombobulated and disoriented, because normally, you know, law enforcement know it's illegal or whatever. They just basically said they don't have the jurisdiction and they can't enforce it.
Right.
And so, you know, then it becomes, you know, then they can get it enforced. And then what you do is it'll trigger almost on itself that if people are calling in and saying, you know, now we have the hundredths person that's been harmed in this different kinds of fraud in this little town, they're going to need to get more resources, or in the state level. So there's no question that there, you know, that if you restore constitutional accountability, the whole point of it is there will be a rule of law and there will be courts
right.
and whatever. And but the choice is you can have anarchy, which we have right now, and there's no liberty, there's no equality, there's no justice. In anarchy, it is might is right, and we've seen what happens when you go there. And so it's literally a law. You know, do we want to live in anarchy and have what's happening now. I mean, an interesting thing I did to tie back to the original kind of the declaration is I did a piece that was sent around, and you probably can see it's like, you know, what's causing America's widespread worsening? And what I did is I looked through the lens of the six goals of the Constitution, and all of them have gotten much worse. So we're less united, less just, less peaceful, less secure, less flourishing, and less blessed. And those are, you know, the form of more perfect union, established justice. Those are all the in the preamble of the Constitution. That also gets me to what we're something that we're doing differently, and what I want to encourage. You know, we're at restoreusinstitute.org, and we would love for people to sign. If you've listened and you heard about this and you want to do something about it, well, what we've done is create a very, I think, accurate, and I say peaceable, civil, and constitutional way of approaching this. We have basically done a declaration of independence from unchecked technological tyranny. And the original declaration in 1776 had 28 grievances. Ours has 20. And the reason we came up with this, I came up with this idea 2 years ago, is I realized the tyrants don't change through the centuries. They do the same thing. Tyrants are tyrants. Mm-hmm. And so we literally have, you know, we've documented the 20 tyrannies. And we've also, and to kind of, you know, simply say it, you know, they've taken away our humanity, they've taken away the concept of justice and the concept of safety online. And that's, those are all tyrannies. But the other thing we're doing, like, it's like if people sign this thing, well, what are we signing? We're saying basically what you're doing is you are restoring the Constitution. So there's a reconstitution aspect. There's restoration of your Bill of Rights and your civil rights and all the other rights you have back online. And then your other thing you're doing that's unique is petitioning for people primacy protection. And that is, right now, we protect platforms from by not protecting people. That's the craziness of how our internet unaccountability policy is. So we protect technology and businesses from regulation, and who's paying for it is all the victims, basically, because no one gets protected. And so how do they become trillionaires? How do they become done so well? But it's all on the backs of the people. And if people, you know, your audience, that's why we're so happy to be here. We the people.
Yeah,
those are the first three words of the Constitution.
Well, we I hate to say it, but we've actually run out of time. I kind of thought we would on this particular topic. We would love it if you came back and updated us. And I hope
Please,
people will go look at your site at restoreusinstitute.org with Scott Cleland. And we've got it all posted for you online. Thank you, Scott. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and I hope we speak with you again. You are.
I hope so too. Thank you.
Absolutely. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
The dreams on which I'm dying are the best I ever had. I find it hard to tell you. I find it hard to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad world.
Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. That was Bill in an unedited version of Blurting.
Blurting.
Nice blurting. Bill the Blurter. Oh, my God. Well, it takes a village, you know. So, welcome to our particular village. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, the Blurter.
You're fired.
Our sponsor...
what about my free commercial?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Free commercial first.
Yeah, we'll put the free people before the paying people.
That's right. Because you know what? You should do it in order. Okay, free commercial this hour goes to Misty McEwen. She's a realtor at Coldwell Banker, and she is awesome. All the way from the start to the finish, I met with her like months before we were ever looking for a house, and I said, look, I don't want to get 10 million listings. I don't want to you know, get dragged to a million places. I'm allergic to cats. I gave her the whole list. And then when I called her like 4 months later and said, all right, the time is now. She picked three houses. One of them was the perfect one. Bought it. Done. I mean, it doesn't get easier than that. Honestly, somebody who actually pays attention and gets the job done and didn't miss a beat, actually. She thought of a lot of things.
No, and she responded every time we had a call or an issue or whatever.
Well, I don't want to put too much pressure on her, but nights, weekends, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
Honestly, and she was really good on the text messaging, which was super helpful when I was at work. So you're looking for Misty McEwen. She's a realtor at Coldwell Banker. You can find her at MISTY, Misty, the number 4, realestate.com. Misty4realestate.com. Simple. And I will be happy to, I'll have the card on me. Actually, she's in my phone because she's a lovely person. So if you need to get a hold of us, you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Phone number, email's there for us, and I'd be happy to reiterate that. And now to the paying sponsor of this hour.
Our paying sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And Pape will get it done. You need a tractor, you need implements, you need service parts. They do it all. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake. So go up and see them. They do great work up there. And or you can give them a call, and their phone number is 226-9226. Or you can get them on the web at papemachinery.com. And that's spelled P-A-P-E, machinery.com.
Deceptively simple, but often confused.
Yes.
And the phone's answered by a human, which anymore actually should be, we should really highlight that.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many places I call now. You get a stinking machine, and the machine wants you to tell it what you want, and it never, like.
I love the ones that give you,
it doesn't listen to
press one for this, press two for
that. That's actually easier.
And yeah.
It's the one that wants you to.
Unless there's like 15 options.
Yeah, well,
and yeah, that gets a little
old. And it used to be you could just press zero and skip the whole thing, but now they're wise to us.
Yeah.
They're wise to us, press zero people. Oh my goodness. Well, so first hour we talked about the internet and all the different problems there. This hour we're going to move on to underpopulation.
Yeah, this is...
Does the world face an underpopulation problem?
Yeah, that's kind of the other side of the coin here. Very interesting.
I know, kind of trippy. So Mr. Toopey is with us, and I neglected to request how I say the first name, so I'm going to hold on that. I'm going to tell you what he does, and then he's going to tell us who he is. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity, and the co-author of a new book called Superabundance, the story of population growth, innovation, and human flourishing on an indefinitely bountiful planet. Sorry, it should have rolled right off my tongue, but it didn't. That's put up by the Cato Institute here in 2022, so it's really current. You can learn more at superabundance.com. He's also the co-author of 10 Global Trends Every Smart Person Should Know, and many others you will find interesting. He's co-author of Simon Abundance Index, and the editor of the website humanprogress.org. So this is like a whole different zone for us. And please tell us how you say your name so I don't have to screw it up for you.
Hi, thanks for having me. My name is Marianne Toopey, and I'm with the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C.
Nice. I would have been close. That was my guess. Thank you so much for coming on. And so this hour, you kind of get to run it. We have a couple of breaks to take, and we'll ask you a couple of questions, but it's yours to...
Yeah, not too many people are
shine
are
a light
saying
on.
We have an underpopulation problem. All you hear about is, oh, the planet is swarming with too many people, and... That's why we're having all the problems we're having, but you have a totally different take on that, and I found it really interesting reading your article.
Well, thanks so much. Yes, right now in 60% countries in the world, something like 107 out of 190, people are having fewer children than is necessary for the replacement level. So replacement level is 2.1 children per woman per lifetime. In most countries in the world, as well as most regions in the world, which is to say Europe, North America, South America, Asia, we are well below the replacement level. In the United States, it's something like 1.7. We are going to reach peak population in about 2060, and after that, population around the world is going to decrease dramatically. And that is going to have negative consequences in all sorts of areas. We have a lot of unfunded liabilities, trillions of dollars, something like $100 trillion, that our government promised to future generations of retirees. Somebody is going to have to pay for it. We have a $31 trillion debt. Somebody has to pay for that. And, of course, economic growth itself may be slowed down if you don't have more people, because people are the only entity in the world capable of coming up with new ideas, new inventions and innovations. And if you have fewer people, you're going to have also fewer geniuses capable of discovering the new drug for cancer, or a new way of communicating, or a new way of transport. So basically, the world is not going to have a problem with overpopulation in the future, but underpopulation.
Well, that changes all the trajectory on the hysteria of limited resource, power, food. I mean, just all of it. All of it is predicated on, and there's a, I don't mind saying, we've done quite a few shows on people that are constantly talking about how we need to have fewer people on the planet.
And coming up
with nefarious ways to get us to that point.
Sounds we've always heard that you know, there's so many people, we're gobbling up all the resources, and we can't sustain it. And yet, some of these numbers that you were giving us show just the opposite. That the more people we've managed to put on the planet, resources, there's more resources, there's cheaper pricing, let's talk about that.
Well, right. Every new baby comes into the world with not just an empty stomach, but also a pair of hands, and most importantly, a mind that's capable of coming up with solutions to the problems that we have. And all you have to think about is, compare the world in the last 200 years. 200 years ago, there was 1 billion people in the world. Today, there is 8 billion people in the world. And yet, the world is about 13 times richer per capita, adjusted for inflation. The United States is 24 times richer per capita, adjusted for inflation. So even though over the last 200 years, the world's population increased eightfold, our standards of living have skyrocketed. Now, this was not supposed to have happened. Most people think that when you have more people in the world, prices are going to go up, resources are going to go down, and, life is just going to be much harder. But that's not what we found. We found that every 1% increase in population decreased the prices of commodities by about 1%. The key to understanding resources is to understand that the finite number of atoms in the world, finite quantity of zinc or copper or whatever, that's actually largely irrelevant. What matters is the human ingenuity, is the new knowledge to be able to get out of those finite resources ever more value. A perfect example of that would be something like a grain of sand. Sand has been around for billions of years. And then some 4,000 years ago, we realized that by heating sand to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, we could turn it into glass jars and later into window panes. And now we are using glass in order to create fiber optic cables, which carry information at the close to the speed of sound around the world, and impacting the global economy. So, the amount of resources may be fixed, but the amount of value that we can get from them is increasing in line with human knowledge.
You also, between 1900 and 2018, you talked about the price of commodities going down with respect to the population. How did that work?
Well, basically what we did was to look at what we call time prices. Time prices is basically just whatever is the price in the shop divided by how much money you earn at the moment that you're buying the thing. and then you repeat the process 100 years or 50 years or 10 years later, and you see how long you have to work in order to afford something. So time price is basically just minutes and hours of work. How long would it take you to buy a pound of beef in 1900 versus now? And what we found was that for the same amount of time that it would take you to buy a pound of beef, let's say 1900, you could get 8 pounds of beef in 2018. So basically your abundance of beef has increased by eightfold. We looked at hundreds of different commodities. We looked at food, we looked at fuel, we looked at minerals and metals. And every single time that we looked at things, it seems like Americans have to work less and less time in order to buy something because their wages are increasing, or at least they used to until the latest bout of inflation. But generally speaking, our wages are increasing at a faster rate than inflation. And also, commodity prices are declining due to productivity gains. And once you put it all together, you realize that we really are extremely wealthy compared to our ancestors.
Mm-hmm. And with more people working, it creates more income, which creates more demand, which creates more goods. And that's really kind of the opposite of
That's right. But it's also the productivity gain. So obviously, if a worker is using a sickle in order to bring in the harvest of wheat, he's going to be much less productive than somebody who is driving a combine harvester. So you can see the productivity gains there. You basically can produce more and more wheat with better technology. We have GMO wheat, which can grow. Our yields are much higher per acre than they used to be, and also our technology is much better. So basically, this productivity of the capitalist system shows itself in both wages and also prices. So prices generally decline as you are able to produce more per acre of land, but also your wages are increasing because you are a much more productive worker. And once you put these together, you realize how much better off you are. And so in the book, if you are simply open-minded and you are willing to look at the data, you can see in our charts how we look at different food items and fuel and such, et cetera, and just see it just dropping. And I think that part of the reason why so many people are disenchanted is because they do not have the proper historical perspective. People generally don't study history, let alone economic history. And so very few people have a good idea about what life was like 100 years ago and how much poorer people were. Now, that doesn't mean that everything in America is working out. That doesn't mean that we cannot improve on things. Of course we can. And especially over the last 2 years, we have made a lot of mistakes. But the bottom line is that the American economic system, provided that it is allowed to function properly, can actually produce higher standards of living, and we can show it with numbers.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're absolutely right. You look at 100 years ago and what it took to, produce goods then versus what it takes today, it's night and day. It's totally different.
Yeah, and it just it's not just food, but also clothing, how much cheaper it is than what it used to be. I mean, in the old days, 100 years ago, let's say the end of the 19th century, you could really see a difference between a rich man and a poor man when you walked into a restaurant or walked down the street. People just dressed completely differently because the poor couldn't afford nice clothing. But clothing also gotten so much less expensive, and people can now afford nice clothing without having to be super rich. So it's a good country to live in, and I think that one of the problems is that right now politically we are so divided that there really isn't a constituency to emphasize the improvement in standards of living. So when Republicans are in charge, Democrats are saying everything is going to hell. When Democrats are in charge, Republicans are saying everything is going to hell. And the reality is that we are living in pretty good time from a historical perspective.
Sure.
Yeah, and if you look back, even the I would imagine if you did the math, when you looked at your example, what the poor have now and what the poor had even 20 or 30 years ago, I mean, what qualified as being poor? I mean, imagine 20 years ago the poor all having cell phones. When you like homeless people all having cell phones and things like that. That would just seem crazy. So yeah, we've elevated the standard of living for everybody at all levels in a lot of cases.
Absolutely. A colleague of mine that I co-wrote the book with, he's a teacher at BYU Hawaii, and he asks his students at the start of every semester, how much would it take for me to take away your cell phone that you can never use it again? And no student ever wanted to do it under $5 million. So basically you have in your pocket this $5 million machine that grants you access to the entirety of human knowledge and the entirety of human entertainment. That's just one way in which we are just so much much better off than our ancestors were. Your typical cell phone has much more computing power than the computer which powered the missions, the NASA missions to the moon. You have better technological capability, better communication skill capability than President of the United States just 20 years ago. And I think that we take all of these things for granted, and we shouldn't.
True. Yeah, mine fell at the gas station the other day and got run over by a car, so I had a self-imposed day of silence waiting for the new one to arrive. The phones are not rugged enough to be run over by cars, just in case anyone was going to go try that at home. Don't do it. It's a bad choice. We'll be right back. We have another 40 minutes to explore this topic, and you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Such a good time, I'm having a ball.
Don't stop me now.
If you wanna have a good time, just give me a call.
Don't stop me now.
I'm having a good time.
Don't stop me
yes,
now.
I'm having a good time. I don't wanna stop at all.
Once I rose above the noise and confusion, just to get a glimpse beyond this illusion. I was soaring ever higher, but I flew too high. Though my eyes could see, I still was a blind man. Though my mind could think, I still was a madman. I hear the voices when I'm dreaming. I can hear them say,
carry on.
Hello?
Don't you cry no more.
Hello, we're back. We did the long version, sorry. Okay, so on the break, we were sort of discussing the idea that, okay, with more people, you have more brain power, which means you have more innovation, and you can advance your society.
If the society is allowed
to
innovate and free think, and that's, isn't that the problem with a lot of these third world countries, is the populations aren't educated and allowed to innovate?
Well, that's right. Population itself cannot be the sole answer to prosperity. China has been the most populated country for 2,000 years.
Yeah, that's the one we were talking about.
Yeah, and same with India. And until recently, they were quite poor. So really, superabundance, which is what the title of the book is, can only be an outcome of population times freedom. It's only people who are capable of thinking freely, speaking freely, publishing freely, exchanging information, and then, of course, acting upon it, such as, for example, investing in the stock market, putting money behind their innovation, marketing it, then benefiting from it. That is the crucial component in superabundance. Now, the part of the problem with the world is that only a relatively small chunk of humanity is living in countries which are plugged into the global economy, people who are enjoying the fruits of the Enlightenment, so people who are enjoying the fruits of economic and political freedom. If we could bring Africa into the global economy and Latin America properly into the global economy and large chunks of Asia, then, of course, we could increase our economic growth, too. A perfect example of that would be somebody like Steve Jobs. You know, his father was born in Syria. And if Steve Jobs himself was born in Syria and spent his life there, he would never have access to the kind of knowledge, to the kind of funding that he was able to get access to in the Silicon Valley. He would just waste out his life in Syria. Part of the way in which you can increase productivity is by bringing smart people into places that are free, or alternatively, you can make the rest of the world free. But of course, we don't want to do that by force, so we just have to hope that economic and political freedom will spread in other places in the world so that those people can also have a crack at accomplishing something in the world. But yes, it is a problem. And of course, if democracies and capitalism decline around the world, then there will be an even smaller sliver of humanity that will be able to participate in this inventive process.
Yeah, because I would imagine there's a very small percentage of the population of the world that's providing for the rest of the population.
That's right. So we assume in our work, and there's some basis for it in evidence, that there is only a fraction of any population in any country which is actually inventors and innovators. We don't think that can be increased artificially. So let's assume that only 5% of people anywhere are innovators and inventors. Well, obviously, you're going to have many more inventors and innovators in a population of 8 billion than you would have 1 billion 200 years ago. But as I said, you know, there is 1.4 billion people in Africa. There are hundreds of millions of people in Latin America, billions of people in Asia. And many of them are not enjoying the kinds of freedoms that we have and cannot apply their minds. They cannot grow intellectually or have access to knowledge and capital that we have. And consequently, the world is probably underserved in terms of the number of innovators and inventors that we could have if the world was really fully free.
And why do you think China, having the largest population, hasn't been able to really crack the code? I mean, as far as providing and feeding their people, is it strictly political?
Primarily, it's political. Yes, China is basically an empire. It is a very, very large country with a lot of people. With the Han-dominated nation. And basically, Chinese have always had to make a choice whether to open up domestically and thereby becoming potentially less stable, or close up domestically and suppress any kind of innovative behavior so as to maintain domestic political stability. And generally, during Chinese history, the regime in Peking, or Beijing, as it is now known, decided that they would much rather have greater poverty and less innovation and less disruption to the system. Because, of course, innovation is very disruptive to the status quo. So when you allow people to think freely, that can be quite disruptive to the central government. And so the decision that the Chinese have historically made was to maintain this high degree of political stability at home by basically clamping down on any kind of disruption, any kind of independent thinking. And obviously, this became most horrific in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s during Mao's time. Mao killed about 45 million of Chinese people in order to maintain this political stability. And China was extremely poor. Then between 1978 and 2012, thereabouts, China has opened up. It became much more free. Of course, it wasn't as free as the United States, not by a long shot, but it was much freer than it was under Mao. And we saw this tremendous growth in the Chinese economy. And then with Xi coming in 2012, he decided to prioritize, once again, stability and Communist Party control rather than innovation and disruption. And as a result of that, Chinese economic growth has slowed down. And, Chinese growth this year will be something like 2%. which by historical standards is very low. So my point is that, yes, as a general rule, it was the political system, the political regime in Beijing, which has been responsible for Chinese poverty, with a short exception between 1978 and 2012. But once again, China is retreating into its shell, and it looks like the Chinese economy is heading for very rocky waters. Indeed, they have a 20% unemployment. They have a very bad population pyramid because of the one-child policy. They are going to have a lot of very old people and very few young people. So China, because of political decisions, has created lots of problems for itself.
Now, as far as the one-child rule in China, when do you think that's really going to, have its peak effect as far as their growth?
I haven't looked at those numbers. I mean, China has stopped the one-child policy in 2015 and then allowed people to have two children. And as of a few months ago, Chinese people are allowed to have three children if they want to. But very few people have been doing it. People have gotten used to smaller families, and they don't seem to be jumping at the opportunity of having many more babies. But within the next 10 to 20 years, there's going to be a lot of Chinese who go into retirement, and there are going to be fewer younger people willing to take those jobs. And it's not entirely clear how China is going to plug that particular hole.
Yeah. Yeah, that when they started that policy, there was a lot of talk about how, in 20 years, when they need to replace a lot of workers, there's not going to be any younger people, and China was going to go into some real hardship.
The control factor, I think, was too, it was too intoxicating, to control everyone's lives like that. They weren't willing to look to the future. It was working for them at the time. And I see that same political philosophy in our, in our energy policy and in our environmentalism and all that stuff. It's all predicated on the politics of scarcity, getting rid of dams so we can get rid of hydropower, which is clean and green and inexpensive, making sure that everybody is stuck with these things that are limited and costly is a great way to control your population. And for whatever reason, we don't seem to be learning from China.
Well, our problems are not connected in any way to the ability of the planet to support human beings.
Right.
The problems that we are facing in the West are due to very stupid decisions made by our politicians. So we are suffering from climate, but not climate change, but climate policies made by our leaders. That's a free choice that we can reverse by electing politicians who have a better understanding of what our economy needs. Now, like most people in California, I think, I'm pretty environmentally conscious. I think of myself as environmentalist in a sense that I want to have a cleaner planet. But I also understand that that humans have to be taken care of. In other words, I think that there was a time when environmentalists understood that human flourishing came first, and if it could be combined with a cleaner planet, that was a good thing. But I think that in the last 20 years or so, maybe slightly longer, that sort of thing flipped. And now extreme environmentalists see human beings as a cancer on the planet.
Yep.
There are articles in newspapers frequently about how the world would be much better off without humans in it, how bringing a child into the world is an act of selfishness and things like that. And I just completely reject that. If there are no humans in the world, then the world doesn't really matter, because the only reason why the world matters is that human beings are there to perceive it with our senses. Animals don't care about the planet. They care about eating, having sex, and not being eaten by other animals. To the extent that the world matters, it's because we are there to appreciate it. So humans matter, And I think that this extremist environmentalism has just gone too far, and we have lost the sight of the fact that human beings are central to this endeavor, human endeavor. And I think we just need to rebalance it a little bit.
Yeah. And that they can be beneficial, that used like any tool, right? Like any tool, you can. Hammers are a good example. We've been using a lot of hammers. We just moved, and so you know,
there's no question.
You wind up fixing a lot of things. You can use it for bad things, or you can use it for good things. But a lot of their policy, when you really dig into it, it used to make you sound crazy, but anymore, you're kind of an idiot if you can't figure it out. That depopulation is the goal. And your article flies in the face of all of that, thank God.
There's no question that the richer the country, the better the environment. This is something that I wish more environmentalists understood. Poor people in poor countries generally don't care about their environment. They drop their trash, whatever they are. They will eat the wildlife if they are hungry. But it is people in rich countries who have the money and who have the focus and who have the determination to keep their environment clean. If you look at environmental rankings around the world, let's say the Yale University environmental ranking, which they publish every year, all the countries at the top of environmental protection and quality of the environment are rich countries. Our air, our factories, our electricity generation is just much cleaner than what it is in poor countries. So if you want to help the planet, the best way to do it is to turn as many countries as rich as possible.
Yeah, increase the standard of living and increase the ability for people. You know, when you're not starving to death and trying to survive, you can spend more time doing good things. But if you're just hanging
not to mention,
by a fingernail, that's all just a bunch of happy talk that nobody has time for. We need to take a really quick break, though. We're going to come right back. Hold that thought because we'll forget it. So you're in charge of it. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Our guest is Marion Tupi. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and the Cato Institute's Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity. I'm finding the fact that you've researched what many of us have just known and watched for such a long time. You've finally put the facts behind it, and that's just incredibly helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those kind words.
Yeah, it just, we have gotten ourselves, it's not everyone, it never is everyone, but the decision makers in our societies, especially in our bigger cities in the U.S., have gotten themselves into this mindset that we have to make everything scarce, and with more scarcity, we can control people better, we can convince people that they shouldn't live in single family homes, shouldn't live in the country, shouldn't have more children, and basically shouldn't be happy. You should feel guilty if you have time to go walk your dog and do pleasant things. That makes you a bad person. And it's like, when did that ever become popular? Ridiculous.
Well, it becomes popular when you can scare people into into believing in this apocalypse. I mean, we've been scaring each other for a very long time, and I think this environmental apocalypticism plays a very large role in it. I mean, after all, you know, global warming may be a problem, but it is not an existential crisis. And this is not something that people are allowed to say. People want you to believe that it's an existential crisis, because, of course, if it's existential crisis, meaning if humanity is on the line, then they can force you into all sorts of behavior which would normally not be acceptable. And I do think that there are aspects of the extreme environmentalist movement which are set on control and degrowth. In fact, there is an academic discipline now emerging. It's called the degrowth discipline or degrowth theory. And basically, it's people in academia basically arguing that we should do with less, that we should stop producing as much as we are producing, that we should stop consuming as much we are consuming, that we should basically become poorer. And, you know, this can only come out of academia, where tenured professors with $250,000 a year in salary are opining about what you and I should be able to consume. And I just completely reject that. I think that there are a lot of people in the United States who could easily imagine their standards of living being higher, not to mention people in the rest of the world who are not as lucky as Americans. And it is a fundamentally anti-American way of looking at things. Americans generally, historically speaking, they always wanted to have more things. They always wanted to be better off, more, better. You know, they wanted the moon.
And it wasn't predicated on taking it away from somebody else. And that seems to be the prevailing narrative now, is if you have more, someone else has less. And that's why I like your superabundance concept, because that's not part of the picture. You didn't deprive somebody because you did well.
Well, that's right. I mean, look, I live in Washington, D.C.
I'm sorry.
So I'm surrounded by people who don't produce anything and take away from others.
Bingo.
I live in a city where millions of people are basically parasites on the rest of America. You produce and we consume. So it's not like I'm completely alien or foreign to the notion of zero-sum game and living at somebody else's expense. But as a general rule, people in America understand that they have to produce in order to consume. They have to drive a Lyft car or Uber. That they have to go to work from 9 to 5 in order to earn their salary. They have to, man the shop floor or whatever in order to get the money. People generally understand that, and even the richest ones among us, like Jeff Bezos, you know, they haven't stolen the money from anywhere. I get 20 packages from Amazon every week or every month because I am willing to part with some of my money willingly in order to get a superior service from Amazon.com or from Apple or from Tesla or whatever. These people have earned their money, and I don't begrudge it to them because again, as I said, they have created a service or a good that all of us in the United States want to use. So, yes, in any society you can have parasites, but by and large, capitalism rewards people who produce for their fellow human beings.
Yeah, as it should. I just can't stress enough how I think the people who listen, well, there are always people who listen to our show just so they can be mad. And, you know, we're happy to provide that benefit for you on Sunday afternoons. But there are a lot of people who listen because they want to find more proof of intelligent life out there. You know, the regular media just gives them the little one-minute thing, and everybody's saying the same 1 minute. We really, really enjoy bringing people like you onto the airwaves so you have time to explain. And honestly, your two websites, superabundance.com and humanprogress.org, I think both of those would be incredibly interesting. We do a lot of things on environmentalism and on the whole Agenda 21 thing, and have for many years. as we do a lot of different things, but that is one thing we've done. And you have a terrific video on there, Climate Alarmists Are Ignoring Science. That caught my eye. And then on humanprogress.org, I see you have Hannah Downey, who's a policy director, Property and Environmental Research Center. But she's got a thing on here, Free Market Conservation and Environmental Optimism. I'm thinking, well, that's sorely lacking. So if people want to read something and listen to things that are like kind of up their alley and maybe not just the same old junk recycled, I would point them to both of your sites. They're excellent.
Well, thank you very much. And I would simply add that, you know, I understand anger, and God knows there's plenty to be angry about
sure.
our political class and so forth, but I would just urge your listeners not to give up on the political and economic institutions which have made this country great. After all, you know, the United States used to be a poor and primitive country just like any other place in the world, and yet you have managed to build this extraordinary, rich, and sophisticated civilization. I say it as a naturalized citizen. Obviously, I'm not from here. But you have managed to build this extraordinarily sophisticated and rich civilization because the Constitution and your institutions have provided for the creation of all this wealth. I would say that a return to the basic American values, such as hard work, long-term thinking, succeeding in the capitalist system by providing your fellow human beings with what they need, we can once again recapture that sense of optimism. So yes, anger is valid, but let's not burn down the institutions which made this country possible. Let's try to change those institutions. Let's try to fix them around the edges. But ultimately, I think that the quintessential American reliance on political and economic freedom is sound and produces results if it's allowed to function properly.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because I think a lot of people are at that point where they're angry at what's going on with the decisions that are being made, and so they're you either have burn it all down, or I'm not going to vote anymore. It doesn't matter. The elections are all rigged, blah, blah, blah. And I get it. And there's ample evidence of those things having problems. But to step away from the whole system and not try to recover it, I think would be the greatest mistake people who believe in the country and what it stands for could possibly do.
I also think that America has within it a perfect system for rebalancing thing, and it's called federalism, something that the Founding Fathers were very keen on. The notion that if you're living in a state which is not functioning properly, you can always move to a place which is functioning better, which offers you the kinds of liberties and responsibilities that fit your personality. One thing that I'm seeing increasingly is that people are moving who are dissatisfied with the governance in their own states to other states, which may have maybe lower taxes and better business environment and so forth. And that's also a valid response to political difficulties, I think. So returning back to federalism and decreasing the amount of intervention by the federal government, by Washington, is, I think, a very promising road back for the United States.
Yeah, and I think what you were talking about there, people moving from state to state, I think that sends a very loud message to those governing bodies that you're going to lose your population if you don't get things, you don't get the ship righted. People leave and go to greener pastures. I think we're seeing a lot of that now, but I kind of have hope that at some point it'll turn around and people will have a little more common sense and bring it back to more, closer to center and not, all the way to the right or all the way to the left. I think we definitely need that balance.
We are in agreement.
Yeah, it's interesting. How long? Give us a little bit. We've got a couple of minutes here. I'm curious about your background. Like, how did you wind up working on this?
Well, I was born in Eastern Europe, in Czechoslovak Socialist Republic, so I was 13 years old when communism came crashing down.
Oh.
And then we left. I mean, we would have left before, but of course they wouldn't let us leave. You know, communism built a wall in order to keep people in, so that we wouldn't leave, otherwise everybody would have left. And then, you know, I was studying in Britain, and when I got my PhD, the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. hired me, and I've been working for them ever since. So, you know, I've been working on Human Progress for about 10 years. And, again, it's been a great experience. When you look at the data, be it life expectancy or calorie consumption or child mortality, you know, things are improving around the world as a general matter, and so there's a lot to be optimistic about if you just look at the data. And we include in our book Superabundance there are chapters which are devoted to human progress in general, showing you how in many ways the environment is improving, how life has improved over the last 200 years. So I hope that your listeners, at least some of them, are open to looking at the data and making up their own minds. I mean, we don't lie. We use the reputable data from around the world to show that the world is really improving as a general matter. Now, the last 2 years have been very difficult for everyone, and our governments have made a lot of mistakes, but you know, over the last 200 years especially, the world has become a better place.
And that's funny, because if you listen to most of the prevailing talking heads out there, they'll all tell you that, you know, all the stories basically sound like life sucks and then you die. And you're busy writing a book called Superabundance. I'm like, what a great world we live in.
Well, and yet,
God bless you.
People say that life sucks and then you die, and yet everybody wants to live as long as possible.
Isn't that
people
funny?
People go through extraordinary lengths to take vitamins.
Yeah, that's
and,
true.
Life-extending drugs, and when they're bedridden with some sort of a disease, they don't want their families to pull the plug on them. They want to carry on as long as possible, no matter how much the expense to the taxpayer. What does that tell you? It tells you that that many people just virtue signal by saying that the world is horrible. In reality, all of us want to live as long as possible on this earth, because on balance, we enjoy it much better than we resent it.
I think they need to all run out and buy Superabundance, and it should be a nighttime reading for every family. Everybody could go to bed happy for a change. Our guest has been Marion Tupi. You are wonderful. We would love to have you back any old time. You're always
anytime.
Welcome here at We the People.
Thank you very much.
You can find this this interview archived at wethepeopleradio.us later this afternoon.
We will rock you.